From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden. On this edition of the program, 10 conflicts to watch in 2018. Our guest, Rob Malley, previously a senior advisor to former U.S. President Barack Obama, now president and CEO of the International Crisis Group, an independent organization based here in Washington, working to prevent wars and shape policies that will build a more peaceful world. Among the 10 conflicts or trends to watch that the International Crisis Group has identified are U.S. retrenchment, North Korea, the U.S.-Saudi-Iran rivalry, the Rohingya crisis, Yemen, Afghanistan, Syria, the Sahel, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Ukraine, and Venezuela. In their report, the International Crisis Group, or ICG, makes a point that, quote, "It's not all about Donald Trump," unquote. While the ICG acknowledges that the U.S. president's brash style, disregard of international accords such as the Paris Climate Agreement, and a seeming readiness to criticize allies and cozy up to adversaries, a more inward-looking United States and a greater diffusion of power are features of an international world order that predate Donald Trump. We'll talk with Rob Malley about the fact that U.S. retrenchment has been in the making for years, hastened by the 2003 U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, as well as the many other trouble spots the ICG has flagged. Prior to joining the International Crisis Group in his current role, Robert Malley served in the Obama administration as special assistant to the president, senior advisor to the president for the counter-ISIL campaign, and White House coordinator for the Middle East, North Africa, and the Gulf region. Before joining the Obama administration, Rob Malley was program director for Middle East and North Africa at the International Crisis Group, where he now serves as president and CEO. And Rob Malley joins us here at the Voice of America. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And as always, delighted to welcome my colleague, Jeff Selden.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, Rob, that was quite a laundry list that I mentioned that your report identifies of the 10 conflicts to watch in 2010. And of course, you said, as I said in the introduction, that it's not all about Donald Trump. These trends were in the making many years before. Therefore, I wanted to ask you, do you think that the Trump administration, this trend toward retrenchment, the so-called America First mantra, to what extent does that exacerbate the crisis you talk about?
No, there's a tendency to overstate the degree to which the U.S. has been retrenching and withdrawing from the world. If you live in the Gulf with tens of thousands of American troops, if you live in Asia, if you live in Europe, U.S. presence is there, it's robust, and for some people it's excessive, by the way, as is U.S. involvement in a number of trouble spots. So I think, number one, we have to kind of nuance that diagnosis that the U.S. is pulling back on itself. On the other hand, it is true that we sort of dated from the Iraq War, but there is a fatigue in the United States. I think you just talked to average Americans. They're tired of the longest war in our history in Afghanistan. They're tired of the war in Iraq. They're tired of our being involved in so many military operations when there's so many troubles at home. And as we point out, if you look at some of the successful presidential candidates, obviously Barack Obama, Donald Trump, and also Bernie Sanders, all of them ran on this platform of, we got to pay more attention to what's troubling us at home rather than what's happening abroad. So I think there is that sort of secular trend of a U.S. that's more weary of getting involved in military operations abroad. But again, it could be easily overstated. We are currently involved in many military operations overseas, and I suspect that's going to continue for some time to come.
But do you think that Washington is ceding ground to adversaries whose values and interests conflict with ours, such as Vladimir Putin's Russia or the rise of China?
Yes and no. Again, when the U.S. intervened in Iraq, was that the best way to promote U.S. influence in the region? We've seen what has happened. Obviously, Iran took advantage of it. If you speak to the Chinese or the Russians, they'll say that was great for them because it allowed the U.S. to be distracted by what happened in Iraq as they tried to gain ground elsewhere. So I think we have to nuance all of these sort of black and white pictures. But it is true that right now you have other powers, China, Russia in particular, that are trying to step in places where either the U.S. is not or where the U.S. is not performing that well. And you know, in some ways, that's a return to what is a logical world order. We may regret it, but there's only a very short period of time, I'd say, where the U.S. could get away with almost anything, if you will. It's between the end of the Cold War and the beginning of the Iraq one. Because before that, obviously, you had the Cold War, where the Soviet Union was very active in many areas. And since then, you've had this diffusion of power, this greater multipolarity. It's not sort of the natural order of things for one country to be as predominant as the U.S. was. And again, for some people around the world, it's not such a bad thing to have. For crisis group, what matters is, can it be better equipped to resolve, prevent, and mitigate deadly conflict, which is what our organization is about and what I think most people around the world would care about, less about who dominates and who doesn't. But are we putting an end to the slaughter of civilians throughout the world, which we describe in our 10 conflicts to watch? And by the way, we're spoiled, unfortunately, in the bad way for choice in terms of how many conflicts we could choose to watch.
To get into some of those specific conflicts, let me now turn to my colleague Jeff Selden.
The first conflict on your list to watch is North Korea. And as President Trump's administration was ready to enter the White House and take hold, intelligence officials were saying that despite everything that had been talked about with so many other crises, military officials had been saying Russia was their biggest concern. That had shifted. How much was missed on North Korea, and how much has the tough talk that the president likes to talk about from his administration toward North Korea is perhaps making a difference? How dangerous is the situation, and how quickly did it become dangerous? Was something missed? And to what extent is the tough talk from the White House, is some of the stuff that we see on Twitter perhaps helping?
So how much we missed, there's been a debate within the intelligence community. All I know is that when President Obama left the White House, when he briefed then-President-elect Trump, he told him the issue that is going to be most urgent and most dangerous for the next administration was North Korea. So obviously, I think this administration, like the Bush administration, the Trump administration, the Obama administration, like the Bush administration before them, did realize that there was something there they had to take care of. The real question is, how come there hasn't been a successful approach to this crisis? So have the intelligence communities underestimated the capacity of North Korea to develop a nuclear program and the intercontinental ballistic missiles necessary to project that power? It's possible, but I don't know that that's the main issue. I think the main issue is, what is the best approach to try to tackle it, which brings me to your other point. I'm not going to get into whether these tweets are helpful or not. Frankly, I think some of them probably are excessive and really helping. How much they hurt is a different matter. What's important is to try to understand what are our objectives with North Korea. Are they realistic, and are our means realistic to get us there? As we discuss in our paper, if the goal is denuclearization of North Korea, it doesn't matter to me what sanctions you impose on North Korea. They're not going to hurt hard enough, fast enough, to prevent North Korea from moving ahead with its nuclear program. Kim Jong-un is not about to give up his nuclear program. Perhaps sometime in the future, but today that's not going to happen. You say, is the pressure working? It's working to hurt North Korea's economy, no doubt about it. It's gaining the world's attention, no doubt about it. Is it working in terms of the goal that the administration itself has set forward, which is to force North Korea to accept denuclearization as the outcome, to stop its missile tests, to stop its nuclear tests? At this point, the evidence points to the contrary, that that pressure may work in hurting the economy. It's not working in getting North Korea to stop what the administration wants it to stop.
Another area where the administration has talked tough but is now also beefing up its presence is in Afghanistan, number 5 on your list of the crises to watch in 2018. How much of a difference will that increased presence make? We've heard Afghan officials talk about how merely the additional U.S. air support has made a difference on the ground, but ultimately, will it bring the Taliban to the negotiating table for a settlement? And also, there's been a lot of back and forth between the U.S. and Pakistan now, the U.S. trying to pressure Pakistan more to get its results. How does this all play out as the months go along and as the U.S. action on the ground in Afghanistan will ramp up?
Again, this is a case where the strategies that have been put in place up until now, whether it's the Bush administration or the Obama administration, haven't put an end to this, the longest war in U.S. history. Will the addition of some 1,000 troops make a decisive difference? I have to say, it's most experts that we've spoken to and our own folks would say hard to conclude that. I mean, at one point, there were far many more troops, 100,000 troops in Afghanistan. That didn't resolve the war, so why would now getting to 30,000, or even if you increase it, why is that going to put an end to the war? There has to be military pressure, there's no doubt about it. But there also has to be a diplomatic track. And to say the goal is to bring the Taliban to the table, sure, but the question is, what are you proposing to them? Is the U.S., is Afghanistan also, what are they prepared to put on the table? Or what are the incentives for the Taliban? Which is not an easy equation, because this is an organization, a group that has done very spectacularly damaging things and harmful things to us and to, well, mainly to the Afghan people. But there needs to be this diplomatic track, and our concern is, sure, you want to get more leverage militarily. That may or may not help. But what's the diplomatic strategy? And that brings us to the question of Pakistan. Pakistan has been a troublemaker, no question about it. It has supported groups that we are opposed to and that is hostile to the Afghan government. But is pressure on Afghanistan of the type that we've just seen announced, is that going to make them change what is a strategic calculus for them? They are using their support for certain groups for their own strategic reasons, for what they consider to be self-defense. So again, this needs to be accompanied with a diplomatic strategy that meets Pakistan's vital interests, Afghanistan's vital interests, India's vital interests. And that's the kind of multilateral diplomacy, which I'm not saying the administration is not going to get to. It seems to me that at this point, they are in the phase where they believe they need to rebuild U.S. leverage, U.S. credibility. Let's see if that works, but it has to be accompanied sooner rather than later with a diplomatic approach, whether it's to the Taliban, whether it's to Pakistan, whether it's to the other countries in the region. And we were just talking about the diffusion of power. You have many more actors now that are involved in the Afghan context. You have China, you have Russia, you have India, you have Iran. So different countries that are supporting different groups. This is not going to be resolved by a go-it-alone U.S. policy. It has to be resolved multilaterally. And putting pressure on Pakistan only makes sense in that context.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Rob Malley, former senior advisor in the Barack Obama White House, now president and CEO of the International Crisis Group, an independent organization working to prevent wars and shape policies that will build a more peaceful world. I'm Carol Castiel, along with VOA national security correspondent Jeff Selden. And this is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to valued listener and Facebook fan Nawab Behdad from Afghanistan. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our guest, Rob Malley. And Rob, I'd like now to turn toward the Middle East, where you identify a number of crises, whether in Syria, whether Yemen, or whether as a result of the U.S.-Saudi-Iran rivalry, particularly Syria. You've dealt with this part of the world throughout your career. We're looking at Syria after 7 years of war. Bashar al-Assad, who was supposed to have gone, who was supposed to have been defeated, has now the upper hand, thanks largely to the backing by Tehran and Moscow. From Barack Obama to Trump, we've heard this mantra that Bashar al-Assad is not fit to rule, and yet he has the upper hand. What are we looking at? We've seen so many refugees fleeing, particularly the depredations of the Assad regime, notwithstanding the terrible atrocities committed by so-called ISIS, the Islamic State. They have mostly been routed, but they're probably just regrouping. What are the implications of this terrible crisis?
So very quickly, I mean, obviously we could spend hours on Syria. At this point, as you say, whatever the goals and the aspirations, perhaps a bit idealistic or naive about how quickly Bashar al-Assad would leave, let's put those to the side. He's not going anywhere at this point. There's no evidence of it. And the question, again, the priority for an organization like ours, like Crisis Group, is how do we end, or if not possible, to end, reduce the levels of violence to a point where Syrians can begin to resume a quasi-normal life. It won't be a normal life for some time. It means a displaced person, people returning to their homes. You mentioned millions of refugees coming back to Syria. It means rebuilding the country. It means ending the violence on the ground. And there, we are seeing the outlines, and we talk about it, of sort of pockets of stability. And the question is, how do we manage those to make sure that the fact that Syria is now becoming more and more an arena for the proxy wars that are commanded by others, whether it's Iran or Turkey or Russia or the United States or the Gulf countries, that needs to be addressed so that they don't use Syria yet again as a playing field for their own competitions for influence and power. And that's what we propose, certain steps that could be taken to make sure that you don't have any confrontation between Israel and Hezbollah and Iran in Syria, that you don't have a confrontation between Turkey and Kurds in Syria, that you don't have a confrontation between the U.S. and Iran in the eastern part of the country. Those are the things that people have to focus on now. The idea of regime change, of changing Assad, I know that that was a priority for many of those Syrians who rose up, but at this point, the urgent necessity has to be not just to end the violence, but to make sure that we don't ignite yet another series of confrontations because of the geopolitical competition that is playing out in that country.
Well, my fear is just the very presence of the Iranians and the Russians there are going to be
an irritant, to say the least, for those rebels, those who rose up. So that's going to be a problem. But at any rate, let's move on to Yemen, another terrible tragedy, again, exacerbated by these proxy conflicts between Iran and Saudi Arabia. We have the Houthi rebels there who have perhaps a loose affiliation with Iran, but have their own identity within Yemen. And yet now we're looking at Yemen as the war ground for, again, Saudi Arabia and Iran playing out their proxy conflict. When is this and how is this going to end?
And this is one of the worst humanitarian catastrophes that we face today in terms of famine, in terms of cholera, in terms of displaced people. And it's one in which, unlike the case of Syria, the U.S. can play a predominant role. And I say this as somebody who worked on Yemen in the Obama administration. It's one of my deep regrets that we weren't able to do more to advance a peaceful solution, because there is one that can be achieved. It's one that has to do with a division of power. It has to do with decentralization. It has to do with trying to find a way to meet the interests of different constituencies. And as we've written in many of our reports at Crisis Group, the ties between the Houthi and Iran exist, but they're not historically grounded. They're not sectarian grounded. They're not ideologically grounded. They can be, if not ended, they can be attenuated. But for that, there needs to be a different approach by Saudi Arabia, by the United States. Of course, the Houthis are going to have to change their ways too. But it is doable. And at this point, given the U.S. involvement, there's a real opportunity here. And given the improved relations between the United States, Saudi Arabia in particular, there's a real opportunity here for the Trump administration to play a role and try to drive a diplomatic process using its influence and its leverage with Saudi Arabia, meeting core Saudi needs, but also making sure that this war, which is destructive to the Yemeni people, of course, but is also costing Saudi Arabia a lot, bring it to an end.
Well, a corollary question then on another crisis that you identify, and that is that rivalry between the U.S. and the Saudis and Iran in the region for hegemony, for power. And I must say, I may be wrong, but I observed that in the Obama administration, because the Obama administration was so focused on getting the Iran nuclear deal, they perhaps turned a blind eye, and some analysts say that they allowed the Saudis as a way to appease them or to pacify them because they were not in favor of this Iran nuclear deal. The Obama administration perhaps tacitly allowed them to do what they wanted in the region and possibly even in Yemen. But let me ask you, how does this proxy war between the Saudis and Iran exacerbate not only the conflict in Yemen, but just their power struggle? How does it affect the entire region? We're seeing the Gulf states who have a problem with Qatar. So all of these things are mushrooming.
I'm not going to sit here as a lawyer for the Obama administration. Obviously, I would have a very different view of whether the U.S. under that administration turned a blind eye to Iran. But
to Saudi Arabia's.
I think, as we point out, this is a conflagration waiting to happen. There's so many places where this conflict between Iran and its allies on the one hand, United States, Saudi Arabia, and their allies on the other hand, are playing out. You mentioned Yemen. It's Yemen, it's the Gulf, and you could have a confrontation there that could very quickly escalate in a direct confrontation either between Saudi Arabia and Iran or between the United States and Iran. You have proximity of forces in Iraq, U.S. forces, Iran or Iranian-backed forces. You have proximity of forces in Syria, you mentioned earlier, U.S. and U.S.-backed forces, Iran and Iran-backed forces. So from one place to the next, you have Lebanon, of course, with Hezbollah's presence and the risk of a confrontation with Israel, which could draw the United States in. And our take is there are so many potential avenues of conflict. There's so little diplomacy because the U.S. right now is not talking to Iran, and Saudi Arabia and Iran are not talking either. So many sources of tension and conflict, so little diplomacy, so many opportunities for things to go wrong. And all it would take is for one thing to go wrong. In order for things to go right, everything has to go right. First of all, de-escalating tension, not turning the region into this playing field for the proxy war, for this war of competition between the U.S., Saudi Arabia on the one hand, Iran and its allies on the other, and resuming diplomacy. That's what's been sort of a key ingredient that's been missing. When's the last time there's been a high-level talk between the U.S. and Iran? When's the last time there were high-level talks between Iran and Saudi Arabia? Even with the best of intentions, things could go awry because there's miscalculation, misunderstanding, lack of communication.
It's tempting to focus on the U.S., President Trump, and his tweets and the way he's conducted foreign policy. But how much of an appetite is there for diplomacy with these other countries, with these other players, with these other groups, whether it's the Taliban, whether it's North Korea, whether it's Iran, to actually sit down and discuss? It seems like a lot of what we see is a sense from different players on the world stage that if they go it alone, they may have a better chance of achieving whatever their aims are, as opposed to trying to work through the post-World War II international order, the UN, and other bodies like that. Is it just the U.S., or is there really a lack of an appetite for this type of talking, this type of diplomacy on the world stage that makes it even more dangerous?
And I have to say, when I was in the administration, I would read op-eds or articles, people saying, just do more diplomacy, end the war in Yemen, bring the Saudis and the Iranians to the table, get the Taliban and negotiate with them. I think easy to say when you're outside. When you're inside, you have other countries that have other interests that may not be operating on the same timetable we are. I mean, for the Taliban, this could go on another 10, 20 years. They think they have time on their side. And that's true, by the way, of many non-state actors around the world who are prepared to wait us and others out. So when we call for diplomacy with the Taliban and a tough but a real negotiation with them, because they are an actor that you can't ignore, when we say you should talk to Pakistan and Pakistan could hurt the U.S. just as the U.S. can hurt them, it's not in a naive sense that we think just by calling for talks they're going to occur. They may not occur, but that needs to be the end goal, and the other steps need to be leading to that, because you're not going to resolve these problems militarily. We've tried to resolve Iraq militarily. We tried to resolve Afghanistan militarily. We tried to resolve Syria militarily. It doesn't work. And so, as I say, it's easy to make those points when you're outside of government, and I don't want to immediately fall in that same trap of saying that's all you need to do and it will work. We know the limitations. We know the complexities. Our analysts live on the ground. They know that these actors have their own interests and are not simply going to abide by U.S. demands or U.S. timetable. But we try to provide the best advice. Here are their interests. Here are the pressure points that one could use. Here's the leverage that you could use. But in the end, these conflicts are only going to be resolved at the negotiating table if they are going to be resolved at all. So I take your point. We're not trying to make it sound like these are easy challenges to face or they would have been resolved by now. But the other thing I learned in government is sometimes the military option, a drone strike, military counterterrorism, those are the toolkit that you first run to. And they're not always the best, or they're not always the best in isolation. And the other ones that are difficult, that take more time, have to be focused on as well.
Well, it seems to me that there needs to be some kind of combination thereof. We talked about Syria earlier. Many analysts say that had the United States done more on the ground with the Free Syria Army to help them with either weapons or diplomatic expertise, that there could have been a chance. In other words, in order to get to the negotiating table, you need to make headway on the battlefield.
But I think that, again, this goes to my point earlier. It's not as if it's simply a matter of, well, why didn't you try hard on diplomacy, or why didn't you take some military strikes? Again, we could have a whole session on Syria, but the history of U.S. involvement in these conflicts in the Middle East is not one that should lead anyone to feel that it's just easy to help militarily one side and the war would have ended. But
Nobody's saying it would have been easy. Nobody would say. Nonetheless, a red line was drawn. Chemical weapons were used. Moscow invaded eastern Ukraine, which is another crisis on your list after the so-called red line was drawn. In other words, there was that sense of, okay, the U.S. isn't going to do anything.
And they intervened in Georgia after the Iraq war, so I'm not sure that Russia's behavior, it's not all about Trump, you said. It's not all about the United States either. Countries have their own interests. They pursue them. They don't necessarily follow what they think the U.S. is going to do. But we do cover Ukraine. It is a problem that we think needs to be resolved. We do obviously criticize Russia's behavior there, and we've had some ideas, not just in this report, and the humanitarian situation in Ukraine is also one that we're deeply involved in and concerned about. But we put out some ideas about what kind of peacekeeping force might be introduced if the Russians are open to it. Because they have dangled this prospect of perhaps having some peacekeepers, but their idea is one that would freeze the conflict, not resolve it. We've tried to move forward with more productive, we think, approach, a more constructive one that would address some of Russia's interests and their concerns, but respect the sovereignty of Ukraine and make sure that the conflict, rather than escalating, can be de-escalated and ultimately ended.
In the very few minutes we have left, Rob, I know there are many other crises to address, but I do want to touch on a couple of them very briefly. And, of course, the Rohingya crisis in Myanmar and Bangladesh is one that really affects me deeply, because it seems just extraordinary, a failure of the United Nations, of perhaps the United States, and yet it's more of a regional problem. But you have the Muslim Rohingya who have lived in Burma, Myanmar, for centuries, but are seen by Myanmar as somehow aliens. There was this crackdown. They are trying to flee for their safety. Bangladesh cannot really absorb them. What are the implications of what is a regional crisis, but which has major ramifications in terms of how we treat ethnic minorities? And then you have, of course, the situation of Aung San Suu Kyi, a Nobel Peace Laureate, who also is perceived as not doing enough for these people.
I think the critics would say not just not doing enough, but doing the wrong thing. But yes, this is very high up on our list. 700,000 have been forced to flee their country. They're living in squalid conditions in Bangladesh, one largest refugee population in the world, which could be a breeding ground for criminality. Perhaps some extremist groups will try to take advantage of it. And with consequences for Bangladesh, which has to sustain this enormous burden, and then ultimately for Myanmar and for the Rohingya who remain in Myanmar and for those who should be returning if the conditions allowed. Unfortunately, they don't, and they probably won't for a while. So this is, of the, all the humanitarian crises that we face over the last few years and that we're going to face in 2018, if not the worst, very, very close to the worst, and something needs to happen. Again, we're in the business not of simply condemning and criticizing, although we could do plenty of that, but of coming up with as much as we can practical solutions. And we have, at this point, our interest is in making sure that those Rohingya who remain in Myanmar don't also suffer the consequences of this conflagration, and that those who are living in Bangladesh, that we find that we pave the way for their return, but their safe return, their voluntary return, and their return under circumstances where they won't face what they face now. But you mentioned the case of Aung San Suu Kyi, and this is where this is really goes to the kind of work that we do. Yes, the role she's played has been one that certainly doesn't live up to her Nobel Peace Prize, to say the least. She faces a situation where that point of view, the nationalist's point of view, the anti-Rohingya point of view, has the quasi-unanimous support of her people. And, you know, those are the politics. And if all politics are local, all politics are also national. And that's something that we can't accept it or justify it, but we have to take it into account, that there is a strong nationalistic feeling which expresses itself in racist and discriminatory feelings towards the Rohingya. But this is where we need to come up with solutions that are not simply censoring and condemning. That we can do that, and we actually advocate some forms of sanctions to make sure that they understand there's a price to pay and that other leaders around the world know that ethnic cleansing doesn't go unpunished. But we also need to think of practical solutions for those people whose lives are at stake, whether they're in Bangladesh or still in Myanmar.
Let's end on a note of your choosing. We didn't talk about the Sahel, DRC, Venezuela, but of the other crises that you discuss, how would you like to end it?
Obviously, we haven't spoken about Africa, and I must say Africa is the one where we probably had the largest choice of conflicts to follow. And so whether it's DRC, which is one of the most, and again, it doesn't really attract attention in the United States, but one of the worst crises, a country that is so wealthy. I mean, it is extraordinary when you list the minerals and the raw materials that they have, and their country is living the way they are. This is a case of leaders that are accumulating riches for themselves and ignoring the betterment of their own people. And this is a case where there needs to be real pressure from African states as well as Western states on Kabila for him to live up to his commitment to leave office. Second term is over. He needs to leave. He was supposed to leave last December. Now he needs to leave by the end of this year. And then we need to see a real transition towards a different form of governance that is going to look to the needs of its people and not to the needs only of those who rule, and a narrow portion of its rulers at that. We could speak about the Sahel, but DRC is obviously, it's such a striking case where one has to understand the roots of conflict. They're not ethnic in this case. It's not religion in this case, although it's not tribal. It really is the case of a kleptocracy that is accumulating resources, wants to keep those resources, and that has to be broken.
Well, for more on the 10 conflicts to watch in 2018, you can go to the International Crisis Group website. Rob Malley is president and CEO of the International Crisis Group. Rob, thank you so much for coming in, sharing your
truth. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Appreciate your insights. Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guest. Our engineer was Joe Gill. And joining me on the program was VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.